Welcome to our live bike shed.
That feels surprisingly good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
We have Eric Passon on as a guest. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Hi, Derek.
Hi, Sean. Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
So what do you guys think about Action Cable?
Well, I thought that since this is live, that means I've always wanted to do live broadcasting so that I can get naked and run around and no one can do anything about it.
Let's not do that because I'm pretty sure that is against the code of conduct.
Sorry, Action Cable?
Do we actually want to talk about Action Cable? Have you been talking about it all week and are tired of it?
I'm tired of tweeting about it, especially since I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. Like how your tweet yesterday was like, I'm on Rails Core and I've never seen this thing before. Right.
Apparently it got mentioned in Campfire once, but that was it. I don't think we actually talked about whether or not it would go in or anything like that. But yes, it is interesting. Interesting. I'm doing air quotes for the listeners. Air quote interesting.
What can you do, right? So if a feature is decided and they decide that they think it needs to be extracted from Basecamp, and then we don't talk about it, I guess.
But I think, I mean, it's hard to have a conversation about a feature that's like being billed as like a major feature of Rails 5 that nobody has seen. Like we can't comment on like... We were talking earlier to Sam Saffron about it, and Sam was like, well, he's been working with WebSockets, and there were all these problems with it, and he fell back to long polling because it was much more reliable, right? And, like, if you can't look into the implementation of these things, we have no basis to have a real conversation about these things. We just have vaporware at this point.
Honestly, the good news is I talked to DHH about it last night, and it sounded like he seemed okay with just making it a dependency in the gem file when you actually install Rails. Like, it just goes into the gem file, like... Rails doesn't actually depend on it. I mean, yes, it'll be another thing you have to delete from the gem file when you create a new project, yeah. But at least there's no hard dependency on it. So
then now what we're left with is new turbo links and other thing that is basically going to be treated the same way as turbo links.
What was the other thing?
Action cable. If we're saying that like it's going to be broken and then we're just going to remove it, but we can, and that's a good thing, but then that's literally so we have more turbo links and more turbo links.
Do you guys not use turbo links?
No, we don't use turbo.
Do you use turbo links?
I have never tried it. I've only heard problems with it, so I can't speak from experience. Do you use turbo links?
No, I don't use turbo links.
Okay.
Does anybody in this room use turbo links?
Okay. We got a couple.
All right, we got a couple.
Okay. Right.
We're going to talk to you guys after.
P-Jax.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you actually want that specific behavior and you want to be explicit about it, something like P-Jax is a really good solution. Like, the API that – one of the APIs they showed where the server actually, like, was able to – with the change and then an ID, but in the view and in the markup, there was absolutely no indication that it was going to be a partial page update or that that was even possible. I'm just imagining that the Stack Overflow questions coming in from new developers, because that just is very implicit magic behavior that completely changes – the meaning of your app, and if you're doing something wrong and weren't expecting, I can just see that being my form stopped working and I can't tell why, and there's nothing in the view or around where the form is being built that would indicate that would happen.
Yeah. I don't care, man.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, I mean, so Sean, you were saying like, okay, so great, Rails 5 is going to be these two things that people are going to pull out of the gem file. That's fine by me if there's also all this other stuff we were talking about, like. Active Record gets a little bit better through some attributes API stuff that you're doing.
Yeah.
Performance gets better through some stuff that Aaron talked about this morning. Like, what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Those are the marketing features, but then everybody else gets all these other features. That sounds great to me.
Yeah, I'm actually fine with it. Honestly, if this cable thing is just part of the gem file and something else that we can just remove if you want to, I don't care.
That seems like a great way for any major new feature to enter Rails. It's like in the gem file first.
Yeah.
Or as a gem, then maybe in the gem file, then maybe in Rails. But
honestly, I think it would be better if we, in order to enter Rails, it would be much better if we copied like the Ember pattern, which is submit an RFC for it. And you have to actually, even the core team members have to submit RFCs for it and actually discuss it publicly and stuff. I mean, I'm not really excited about including this thing that's like, hey, we've got this thing and nobody's seen it before. It's only inside of Basecamp, and then we're just going to like throw it up on GitHub and good luck. Woo!
Yeah.
Has that RFC thing been discussed before and just shot down, or is this something we're going to discuss now?
It'll never happen.
Yeah, I can never see that getting through.
That'll never happen.
But no, it would be. I think one of the issues with that pattern though is that it does lead to kind of really turning into waterfall API design and bike shedding on like what the external API looks like before getting into the actual implementation of the thing.
Well, but I think that's where the core team members come in. Is like, we can say like, if other people are coming along and bike shedding on the thing, it's like, no, we don't care. It doesn't matter.
Okay, fair enough.
The peanut, don't listen to the peanut gallery, right?
Fair enough.
Let's move on to something else that's
more fun. Yeah, let's talk about something less depressing.
What are you excited about?
What am I me?
Yeah. You know.
I don't know. What are you excited about? I'll tell you what I'm really excited about. You ready?
Yes.
Happy hour.
Yeah. That is the great thing, is that there will be beer after.
No, I'm excited about the performance stuff that I've been working on, especially I'm really excited about deleting controller tests, just because I want less code in there. I'm also fairly excited about, well, not fairly, I'm very excited about the template caching stuff that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. If we can get around the challenges that I was talking about in my talk. If we can get around those things, I think that'll be like a very huge win, especially for folks who are running on like low memory places like maybe Heroku, for example.
Right. I mean, when you talked about that this morning, I kind of assumed that's how this always worked. So I was surprised to learn that we're constantly compiling.
Yeah, it's actually pretty interesting because when people think like, oh, we're doing eager loading, you know, we eager load our application, they think, oh, we're eager loading the entire thing. When that's not actually true. We're eager loading all of your models and stuff, all the library code that we can. But as far as views are concerned, no, not at all.
All right. So for people who haven't seen the talk yet, the listeners on this who may not have seen the video.
Should I explain?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, so basically the problem is that Rails always lazily compiles your views. So if you have ERB or HAML templates, those things don't get turned into Ruby. The templates get turned into Ruby and they're evaluated, but that process doesn't happen until a request comes in. So when a request comes in, then we look for the template that needs to be rendered, and then at that point is when we look and see, has it been turned into Ruby yet? If not, we turn it into Ruby, and then we evaluate that Ruby and then run the template. So the problem with that is if you're running a threaded web server, we actually have to lock there because it's a race condition. We have to do a check and then compute. Mm-hmm. Right? Now, the other problem is that if you're running a forked server, you're repeating work among all the child processes. So that evaluated Ruby is loaded into memory, and that's repeated across all the child processes, which means that you're wasting memory because we could have been doing it in the parent process and then sharing that among all the children. So what we're talking about for Rails 5 is essentially getting it so that we can compile all those templates in advance so that hopefully threaded servers won't have to lock anymore because it'll always be 100% cache hit, and forking servers will get a memory reduction because they'll be able to share memory with the parent process.
You know, I wonder once we get that done, or even I guess in parallel, because I'm wondering if there are other low-hanging fruit in views in particular that we might be able to tackle. Like partials, for example, when you extract them, right, certainly have a cost as opposed to if you had just had that markup inlined. And it seems like when you're not doing polymorphic rendering, we should be able to, at compile time, actually just inline them for you. And that would potentially, depending on how you structure your views, could actually be a big win.
Yeah.
Yeah, I ignore the partial penalty. Like like my dream partial is one that has like one line. And I'm like, great, this is great. Keep extracting partials, keep going.
Yeah.
But I do that too. I think it's fine. You should. Right. Come on.
We should just get rid of the
I liked your thing, like you were talking about how locals are the problem in this precompiling the views thing, and you were like, I want to be very clear here.
Keep using locals.
Right, because I think people can hear this and be like, oh, I'm never going to use this again because it's a problem or whatever.
Yeah, it's an implementation detail, right? It's none of your business. You shouldn't know that. You don't need to know. You don't need to care. That's something we'll deal with, and then your stuff will just get automatically faster.
Yeah.
Now, I have to admit, like, these new features that DHH was talking about, the cables and the stuff... Sorry, the turbo links and stuff. Part of me is afraid that it's just a gut reaction towards I hate new features.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what I mean? Like, I'm a performance guy, and when I use Rails and I'm building an application, I'm like, it has everything I need. What do I need this cable crap for? Mm-hmm. What is this for? You know what I'm saying? And then as soon as I hear we get this new stuff, I'm like, okay, I guess I'm gonna have to refactor that.
Right.
That's the first thing I think is like, I wonder how much I'm going to have to do. How much work is this going to cause me? What's the performance issues? What am I going to have to handle with this? So I don't know how to reconcile that with myself. Is it just like a knee-jerk reaction that I hate new things, or...
I mean, I don't know. Why is there this assumption that we do have to have new features? I mean, we do not exactly have a stable platform to build on. We have gems breaking every version, and part of that's because our internals are still a mess in a lot of really important places. And every new thing coming in that touches every other file and ultimately ends up disrupting a lot of the work that you do on performance and that I do for performance and maintainability, like that it can be disruptive to it. And I think that the majority of users of Rails are in the same mindset of you. It's just, why do we need this? I don't think you're wrong. I mean, I think you're right in that that might be the knee-jerk reaction to new features, but I think a lot of people potentially share that.
Well, at the same time, we still need to push the framework forward. I mean, like...
What does that mean?
But you can do that. Like, the new features to me that are interesting are like... I'll be able to use OR in Active Record. That's great. That's a new feature to me. I'm happy about that. Like, there was, in Rails 4, there was none. None was helpful. Like, all these things are new features. Like, we don't need a new gem with an action name in order to be
it's a tentpole. It's Rails 5, man.
Yeah.
So Rails 5, let me tell you, Rails has not been in its prime since Rails 3. Sorry, that was bad. That was terrible.
When'd you come up with that one?
Oh man, that one's been up here for quite a while. I was trying to find the right time to say it. I was considering whether or not to put that in my list of opening puns.
Those are good. I thought you were going to come back to those. I thought you were like, I'll just scroll through some more of these. if I start to look out.
No, I thought people were getting tired of them. I tell the first one, it's just crickets. I'm like, it's 9 in the morning, isn't it?
those are my kind of new features, like just little things. There's so much little stuff that can make my life better day to day developing Rails applications. Whereas the action cable thing, like maybe it'll actually be something I use. I don't know, but it doesn't solve an obvious problem.
When I think about pushing the framework forward, I think about things like HTTP2.
Yeah.
Things like
yes.
that.
So. Yeah, but we don't need like a new big shiny thing to support HTTP2. I mean, is there any application facing changes that are impact of HTTP2 other than server push?
Besides server push, no.
Would if you had full HTTP2 compatibility, places like things like concatenating your assets and stuff go away?
Right, but that's you still just include all of your JavaScripts, and we have the manifest, be it in the same form we have now or in a separate new file, what have you, but. Maybe is a one-line change.
Sure. What else do we need to do for HTTP2?
I need to finish work on Rack.
Rack, yeah. I think you were talking a while ago about Rack, the problem of the stack depth. Was that you?
Yeah. I was talking about that. Stack depth issues has gone away with Ruby 1.9 and up, but not from a debuggability standpoint. The performance impact is not there anymore, but as far as figuring out what the... Can I use swear words on this?
You can, and we will bleep you if we don't like them.
What the hell is
that?
By we
mean
what
Tom.
Is the, what the hell is the application doing? You see that whole stack? You like puts call. So I'm a really terrible debugger.
Okay.
Let me tell you how I debug things. I go in and I do puts hi mom, and then see if the code actually executed, and then I'll do like puts caller, and then I look at the stack trace and like follow through it. But when you do that inside of a view or something, it's like. I'm like, I remember being a J2EE developer. So, I mean, it would be nice to get rid of that stuff, but it's not really the call stack which is such an issue anymore. It's the fundamental design of Rack just doing call will not work with HTTP2. We just cannot use that. It is not a pattern we can use.
I mean, so are we going to try and maintain Rack 1 middleware compatibility? Because you're right. I mean, like the single synchronous request response cycle API is going to have to die eventually.
I think we can. Basically, the idea is, or my proposal for it, and what I've been working on so far is, essentially, you hand an object to the server, and then the server calls a method on it, right? And it just passes a request and a response. And we could keep the method the same as today, just call it call or something. But mm-hmm. I don't want to do that because I want to be able to detect that somebody has given me an old a Rack 1.0 type thing. So I want to call it something else, maybe, I don't know, like serve or something like that, some method. So that when you give me the object, I can say like, hey, do you respond to call? And is the arity of call 1? If so, it's probably, it's a good sign that you may have passed me a Rack 1.0 thing. And I think what we can do is if you give me a Rack 1.0 middleware, I can convert the request object into a hash, hand it off to you, and then possibly do some shenanigans to keep passing it around.
And so you said, you're saying request objects, are we going to have a real request and response object instead of the env hash and the array of three elements?
Yes, that's right.
Yes!
Yeah, I can't remember the order of those things. Or like, yeah. Am I really just indexing into these things?
That's great. Yeah.
Do you think we're going to keep the CGI style header conversion, though?
Oh, I'm sure we'll keep that for backwards compatibility, but I don't know.
Okay, fair enough. Rack is quirky.
Yes, it is. So I'm actually really excited about this type of API because it means we can stick stuff on the request that should be on the request. Like stuff that should go there can go in there instead of jamming it into a hash and being like, oh, maybe it's in there. Let's check for a key. And then, oh, no, there's no key. And then you don't know. Then you don't know whether or not, like, oh, maybe it was supposed to set it before. Or maybe I have the ordering incorrect. Or you don't know what's going on. There's so many problems with that. It's like, okay, if you need to debug anything, how do you tell when this effing hash key was supposed to be set? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I don't even know. I'm going to admit this. I will admit this. I used to be a J2EE developer. I hear the live audience like, yeah. Oh, man, how did that happen? And then, so I came to Ruby, and it was fine. I was doing Rails stuff. It was great. And then I remember Rack came out. I used Rails before Rack came out. Rack came out, and it was like, hey, you get an env hash. And I was like, how is this different than CGI? CGI was the worst because I also used to be a Perl. I was a Perl developer before I was a J2E developer. Yeah. And I'm like, that was the worst. And I'm like, why are we doing this? Is there something? The thing is, though, at the time that it came out, I was new at Ruby. And I was like, well, I don't know if I was new at Ruby. I felt not confident. And I thought to myself, well, they must know what they're doing. Whoever wrote this knows what they're doing. I do not know what I am doing, so I will assume that, yes, some env hash is like, that's fine.
Right.
That's fine. But now I'm like, no, that's stupid. So I guess basically the message that I want to pass on to people is you are probably not wrong.
Right.
If something seems weird, it probably is.
Everything's made by people just like you.
Yes. So. Exactly. Right. Exactly.
How do we solve that, though? Because I think for a lot of developers, like they see Rails as this big, scary... I mean, it is a big, scary thing, but they assume like if they see something that is confusing or that they... But that's wrong, but it actually probably is wrong. Like, Rails isn't smarter than you. It's just a big legacy code base written by normal human beings. How do we get that message out there? Besides this.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you just did it.
Okay, fair enough.
You keep asking us how to say things right after you just said them very eloquently. So,
fair enough. I don't know, but I think it's a problem. Like, it harms our ability to gain new contributors. And I think part of the reason certain files are the way they are is because it's been years upon years of people have a bug, and they go into the file where the bug happens, and they apply a Band-Aid. But then nobody like ever feels – seems. I don't know if it's because they don't have time or if because they don't feel qualified, but then things go too long without like, does this piece of the code, does the architecture of it still make sense with what Rails is today or what this module is trying to accomplish today?
Well, I think in my opinion it's just lack of time in my opinion.
Okay.
Like, doing the stuff, like doing any sort of deep refactoring or deep architectural changes, you have to invest time into doing that. And a lot of the people who are sending in patches, like, they just ran into a bug in their application and they need to get their app working, right?
Yeah.
They need to get their app working and move on to the next task. They don't have time to sit there and be like, well, is this the right way to do it? I just need to get my bug fixed and move on,
right?
Yeah.
And
so
the other part of it, at least for me, like when I go in there and I see a bug and I'm like, oh, I'm going to submit a patch to fix this. Like, the last time I did that, I remember seeing, like, gross duplication in these two different places. And I was like, I could clean this up. And the code was also really hairy. And I was like, I could definitely clean this up pretty easily. But, like, I don't know all of the reasons the code exists in this way.
Right.
And I do not have the time to figure out why and, like, chase down which test failures. And more importantly, if I get the test suite green and somehow that doesn't catch everything, I'm going to feel really bad when this goes to production and people are like, this broke this. right? And I'm going to feel like I had incomplete information. So I feel like I need more. I need, like, it get back to the time. Like, I've got to get.
Yeah.
I really feel like I can't just do something in a day when it's something like that. I'm going to need to spend several days to, like.
So this is, in my opinion, this is why I wish there were more companies who are willing to foot the bill to just pay someone to work on this stuff. Because if you don't have time, if you don't pay someone to just focus on doing that particular thing, they're not going to be able to figure out the architecture or figure out how to improve the code base. We're just going to be getting more bug fixes, you know, hacks on hacks on hacks. And the development style of, well, it works for me, you know, it works for our application, isn't ever going to get you any of the architectural changes that we'd need in the code base.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just not going to pay for it.
The Attributes API took me almost a year, and I was full-time for about half of that, and I still have more work to do on it. Never would have been able to get that done if it was just nights and weekends and Fridays. You lose too much focus when you can't spend the big, big chunks of time on it.
I don't know how we would start doing something like that, but it would be nice if there were more companies who were like, yes, let's pay someone to work on Rails.
Right. Yeah. We get the Friday time at ThoughtBot, which is great, but like the larger changes where you're like, I need 3 days here. Like, am I going to work Saturday and Sunday on this as well?
Right.
Or am I just going to work Friday and then next Friday and then forget about it on the third Friday because now I've lost all my context and I'm disheartened.
And also it's happy hour.
Yeah,
Friday happy hour. I'm done with this.
Tom, how are we doing on time? Should we start the Q&A soon? Okay, cool. So, 15 minutes until happy hour?
15 minutes until Q&A.
Oh, wow.
Okay, gotcha. We are, like, really prepared.
Wow. So, what should we talk about next?
So, how's Nekotsune going for you?
Good. I've got a lot of cats. I've collected a lot of cats.
Derek looks very confused.
What are you talking about?
Have you seen the Twitter, the cat game?
This is the cat game.
This is the cat game.
With the bags over the head.
For the record, everybody who does not have this cat game is lame. Okay. This cat game is awesome.
Okay. So you basically what you do is you set up your backyard with a bunch of cat toys, and then cats come and play with them, and then you get fish. And then you use the fish to buy more stuff for the cats to play
with. Who gives you the fish? Where
do the cats leave the fish, yeah.
That doesn't seem...
It's not supposed to make sense.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay.
This is a game. The cats give you fish. You buy stuff. You buy toys for the cats. And
you buy stuff with the fish.
With the fish. Okay. Yep. And then the cats keep coming. Yeah.
All right. Is this one of those games where it's going to be like you could just buy 500 fish?
Yeah.
You can. Yeah. You can if you want to. But so far I haven't. I mean, I haven't really seen it. It hasn't really seemed necessary. I mean, the cats seem to leave a lot of fish. So.
As cats tend to. Normal cat-like behavior.
So the other things that I've done here at the conference are I've traded Pokemon. You wouldn't believe how many Pokemon I've leveled up. It's really great.
Okay.
What else have I done here? I went up to the bar that spins around, and that
That's
was
a great
exciting.
Bar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the waitress, when they saw your keyboard, and they had never seen anything like it.
Oh, yeah. They really enjoyed my keyboard. They're like, I really enjoy your keyboard.
Yeah.
The only problem I have with the spinning bar is, one, I got kind of dizzy, and two, I was afraid I'd get lost. You get up, you go to the bathroom, you come back, your seat's not there.
You got to walk all the way around.
Yeah, you got to walk all the way around. And I come out, and I'm like, so the bar is spinning clockwise, right? And so I'm like, well, obviously the most efficient way to find my seat, counterclockwise. Right. So.
Last night, Derek found this piece of paper just sitting on the little side thing, and it was just RailsConf 2015, and then there was a column that says mini test, and another one that says RSpec, and people were just checking off their preference as their table went by.
And then putting it back on the railing.
That's funny.
That was good.
That's funny.
It was a good use of a spinning bar.
It was a very good use of a spinning bar.
All right, what's our next topic? Come on, topics. Topics.
I mean, do you want to explore the full-time open source thing more? Do we have ways that we can move the community towards this?
No.
Okay. Moving on then.
I mean, I really don't know. Like, how do the companies that you're working at do it?
Well, my company is an open source company.
So everybody's doing full-time open source.
Yes. Just okay. Not yes.
But you're selling something at some level.
Yeah, we are. Well, I mean, I work at Red Hat.
Right.
We sell
selling
stuff.
Lots of things.
Yeah, we sell a lot. We sell a lot of stuff.
That cloud thing you work on that gets sold.
But everything is open source there. So the thing is, I mean, the trick is you might not be able to dedicate all of your. I mean, everything is open source. It's just that maybe you have to dedicate your time to some particular open source project that is not Rails.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
Ruby Together is taking good steps.
Yeah.
Ruby together?
Yeah. Andre Arco's new thing.
Yeah, so that's like you can pledge some money as a company or as an individual.
Yeah.
And you get some recognition for that, and then it sponsors some... is it specific work, or is it like it sponsors somebody to work on something they like, or how's it work?
I don't know. Do you know?
I do know. I am on the board of Ruby Together, so I can tell you.
Okay.
There we go.
It seems to sponsor some work, but the problem is that the work is not, it's not very specific. So it's basically sponsoring Andre to work on Bundler and RubyGems.org, but the projects that he's working on aren't really stated on the website, so we're trying to work on transparency with that so that people who donate to the projects will know exactly what they're getting for their money. But it's essentially just him working on those infrastructure things.
But and then he's going to continue to choose what he works on, and this is it, to give transparency into that, right? Not to give the companies control over what he works
on. Yes, exactly. So the point of the nonprofit is essentially to have a place to put money that basically no corporate interests can influence what he works on.
Because that's always the big fear, right? Is that with full-time open source, all of a sudden, like now we have Microsoft deciding the future of Rails, and they're just going to kill it because they want .NET to win.
As long as you're using Azure Cloud Services, TM, I don't think they care.
Can you even deploy Rails to Azure?
I can assure you can.
They're here.
Actually, I don't even know if that's true, but it was a good fun.
So are you exploring any other languages at all? Tried Rust yet?
I have tried Rust. Also, Chicken Scheme, which I talked about last year, I think, and the year before, because Chicken Scheme's amazing and you should use it.
Are you still doing Chicken Scheme?
Yes.
Have you published any popular eggs yet?
I've published the only YAML egg. What else? What other ones did I do? Oh, I did one that controls LEDs on your laptop, so you can like flash LEDs and stuff.
Huh.
But cool. Nothing, like, I don't know, nothing like...
You haven't made Rails for Scheme?
No, we already have one. So Chicken already has a Rails for Scheme, and it's called Awful.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Like Awful as in like the meat, right?
What?
O-F-F-A-L?
No.
No?
A-U-W-F-U-L. Oh, okay. A-W-F-U-L, as
in terrible. I thought this was a food pun or something.
No, no, no. Too
okay. Many I can't follow any of these. I'm out. We've been doing Haskell a little bit at ThoughtBot.
Yeah?
Any experience with that?
Yeah, I tried using GHC, but I found it to be a bit of a Haskell.
Set you up for that one. Okay. Q&A time?
Let's go to Q&A.
Q&A time.
Sorry, my attention span is about like that.
No, it's good.
Since two of you have seen dark parts of the Rails code base, are there things off the top of your head that you're like, someone should go look at that, but lack of time kind of thing? Like are there things you would say to the audience now and to the Bike Shed podcast? Like, hey, if anyone has time, like, no pressure.
I mean, like, associations are definitely a thing that need to be completely reworked. That said, it is a big, scary code monster, and I'm not sure it's necessarily where you want to go if you are new to the code base. But that's what comes to my mind as, like, a big, scary thing that I want to really, really take a hard look at but haven't had time.
What's the part that you feel is, like, scary or bad about, like, the problem in it? Because I've, like, dug in there to, like, debug associations, and it's just, like, I haven't been enough to look at it and see, like, oh, that should be fixed or changed.
I would say the biggest one is how we calculate what tables we're joining onto, which I'm not even entirely sure I fully understand that code, but that really, really needs to get reworked. And then just the general structure of it. It's one of those files where I frequently find myself having a hard time finding where the actual logic I want lives. And I'm a fan of indirection, but I still think that when it's just something that stood out to me as we should fix it.
Thank you.
I would say, in my opinion, where I think people should jump in is to fixtures.
Yeah.
Working on fixtures.
What about it?
So basically, like, the stuff I was talking about in my talk about splitting up databases and stuff, the problem is with, so for the people who haven't seen my talk listening, basically what I want to do is have automatic parallel testing against multiple databases. So we would just spin up a few databases and then run. So say we spin up four databases and we run four processes against each of the databases. The problem is that the code that loads fixtures into the database happens so early, it's almost impossible to configure against another database, right? So since it happens so early, we can't, it's very difficult. We're going to have to refactor that in order to be able to support, like, okay, spin up a database and then load fixtures into those, or load fixtures into one database and then copy them over. It's just right. it's too tightly coupled.
Another good one, actually, just thinking of things that would be good for people to kind of get their feet wet but make, like, bigger contributions. The code that Derek was talking about earlier is still, that's probably a really low-hanging fruit. It's just in our data definition API, creating a table versus updating a table. We have similar-ish data structures that are just different enough, and there's a lot of duplicated code around them, and getting that into a single shared code base would be a big help.
You remembered.
I do remember.
Any other cues?
Yeah. I'm not sure if this is too technical, but Aaron, you talked about trying to like extract metadata from templates, and I've messed around in the ActionView codebase a lot from my work with Curly. And basically, what I basically wanted to do was to sort of refactor the entire view rendering process into sort of a two-step thing, where you would actually, you know, let the specific handler load the code and have an object that represents sort of the view or the template, and you can ask it to render itself, but you can also ask it for metadata, because you already do some kind of scraping in terms of template digests that's used for tracking dependencies between templates for caching purposes, and that's also basically trying to scrape out stuff from the template, and it's sort of dirty. And it would be great, at least for like Curly, we would quite easily be able to supply metadata in a more structured form without resorting to that stuff. So it would be great if that could be like a two-step thing, and then maybe even isolate each template from each other, so you wouldn't be able to like pass around state by assigning instance variables, because that's sort of ugly, and it makes implementing stuff really difficult. It would be nice to be able to pass that around as an actual object. I'm not sure if that's like completely out of the question or something you've been thinking about.
Yeah, if we could have an object that just represented the locals that you wanted to pass to a particular template, that would help out a lot. But I mean,
we can't kill Ivars though.
You don't kill Ivars. Ivars stay exactly the same. The problem is that you can say like render local or render template, and then you can do colon locals and you can pass a hash. And the hash can be whatever you want it to be, and it's decided at runtime. You could even have like when a request comes in, you could generate a random number of locals and send it off to a template. Mm-hmm. And since people can do that, it's very difficult for us to cache that stuff. So a template couldn't really provide metadata that would be useful for us, because we need to have that metadata. Well, I might be saying that wrong. Okay. A template could provide metadata to us, potentially, and we could use that, but we need to be able to get that information before runtime. So yeah, because exactly. those locals can be determined at runtime, that screws everything up. Yeah. But if we could say there was one particular object, like if you want to pass locals to a template, you construct this object that has all of your stuff in it, and then you'd have to call methods on that thing. So essentially inside your template, you'd have to say, you know, locals.mylocal, locals.foo, locals.bar, locals.baz. That makes sense?
Yeah, I think it's already available as a hash. I think it's called locals, right?
Yeah, it is.
And
yep.
There's even like local ? Method, right? But the problem is that you also make it available as actual locals, right?
Yep.
But yeah, if you change the API in that way, of course it'll break a bunch of templates, right? But it would make it a lot easier.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we can't make a breaking change that big.
Yeah, we can't. Unfortunately, I can't make a breaking change like that. Yeah. I'd love to. Yeah.
How I'm a little lost. I've got to ask, like, how does doing locals.foo and locals.bar differ from just doing foo.bar? Like, if you could just delegate method missing to locals, right? What's the difference here?
Well, we could delegate the method missing.
No, you can't delegate.
Well, because that'd be slow would be the difference, actually.
Okay.
You can't delegate to method missing, because there's a difference between method calls and local lookup. Like, you couldn't do...
An assignment too, right? Because you can assign inside of a template.
Yes.
Oh, yes, you can.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, if it were a single thing, then we wouldn't have to worry about actually assigning them as local variables. There's always just the one local variable, or even the method that you access the locals object.
Sure.
If you're always accessing the data through that one locals object, then we're free to compile, because we could say essentially any locals that are inside this template were done by you. They were not passed in through anything else. Right. So, I mean, I'd love to get to that point. I just don't know if we could make a breaking change like that.
sorry, have you considered just unifying instance variables and locals? Because it seems to me that it's weird that depending on how a template is being called, it's either an instance variable or a local variable. Why not just only use instance variables? And then you can sort of mutate the view object before actually calling the view method.
I'd rather always use locals.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if I understand you correctly, you're saying just switch everything to IVARs. No, I don't want to do that. I mean, if we switched everything to IVARs, I think it would get super messy. I like having locals, and honestly, I like even better the idea of just passing an object around that responded to some methods.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's even more clean. In fact, that's one thing that we like to do at work. Oh, I'll use a nice buzzword here. You can use a presenter. You pass a presenter in, right. And you're like, call some methods on that thing.
We've been trying to do that on our code, like where you get to the like one instance, you get one instance variable, so you've got to wrap everything up in a nice object.
Yeah, but I also even take it a step further. I don't ever use instance variables. I just do memoized helper methods basically all the time on the controller object.
Interesting.
I'm okay with the IVARs. I think it's fine. Yeah.
They just bug me. I don't know. They've always felt weird.
Thank you. That was a good question. I appreciate it.
There was one point, though, that I wanted to expand upon for a minute, which is just the, you know, like this is a big API change. And one of the things that I'm hoping to start doing with Active Record is really, really splitting it out into internally we have the model layer, the repository layer, the query building, and then the database interface layer. And once we do that, because I think we really need to start exploring alternative query building interfaces. But I think what we do not need is Rails 2.3 to Rails 3.0 all over again. So if we can really make it super simple to swap out just that layer without throwing out the rest of Active Record, we can then start exploring other query builder interfaces, swap those in. I don't know if that means getting rid of Relation as well or not yet, but like, what do you think about that?
I think it sounds hard.
Yes. You have a question.
There you go. Hey, has there ever been or do you foresee ever a Node.io scenario in our community? Kind of this forking of based on disagreements in the core.
I don't think it would ever gain the momentum that Rails has if that happened.
Yeah, I don't see it. I don't think so. No. I mean, besides... I think the core team is pretty good. Like, I don't think we're gonna have too many disagreements that would like divide us so hard that we have to fork. Although I do admit that finding out about new features at the keynote at RailsConf annoys me a little bit.
Right. I mean, the core team's good.
Yes. Yes. So no, I don't think so. I don't think that would ever happen. My opinion, no. Any other questions? Come on. It doesn't have to be technical.
It could be about the cat game. All right.
Yes, yes.
We're back for more.
Do you love your cats equally?
Oh. That's a good question. Oh, my God.
They're not going to listen to this podcast. It's okay.
I can't believe somebody... No, but my wife might.
Do the cats like you or Ebby more?
It depends. Okay.
Don't let them dodge the question.
All right. No. Let's... You know what? Let's just... We'll get this out here, right?
Oh, it's happy hour. Let's
So we got the one cat, Gorbachev. We got him first. And then my wife was mad at me for spending too much time with the cat. It wasn't because she was jealous of him. Like, she was happy with the time we were spending together. She wanted to spend more time with the cat, and she felt like I was hogging him. Mm-hmm. So she decided that we should get a second cat, except that... She didn't sell it to me that way. She sold it to me as, oh, he needs a friend, and so we should get a second cat as the other cat. So we got the second, like, we were looking through other cats, and I'm like, I love this one. And she actually didn't like, so the other one, Choo Choo, she doesn't like her at all. My wife doesn't like her at all. Not at all. She only got her because she wanted me to spend more time with Choo Choo and not with Gorbachev. So,
poor Choo Choo.
Yeah. Well, no, so she, okay. I like them both. I like them both a lot. Although I like her, I like them both for different reasons.
Sounds like real children. This is the same conversation.
Well, I like Choo Choo because
other than the choosing them from a store, but
she's I think it's hilarious because she's ridiculously needy, but only needy to me. She does not care about my wife whatsoever.
Well, she feels she feels that coming from your wife as well.
Yes, exactly. Right. So as soon as I wake up, she starts following me around my apartment. Like, I go take a shower, she's like, oh, I gotta be in there. What's going on? It's the hour time. When I'm programming, boom, there, all the time. And I think it's pretty adorable. Gorbachev doesn't give a shit. He's like, whatever. I don't care about you. I'm a cat. I do whatever I want to. So I don't actually like that. I like spending time with my cats, you know?
Okay, so choo-choo.
Well, except that. So the one bad point about her is you can't pick her up. If you pick her up, she gets super pissed. Like, you pick her up, it's actually really, really hilarious because she doesn't, like, swat at you or anything like that. She just acts like she's going to die. She holds still, like the. Sorry, I guess the people who are listening can't see me, but I'm basically holding. I'm holding my hands up and then making this face like I'm dying. Like,
we actually are on video, so if you want to see this, you can go get the video feed, which will be in the show
everybody.
Notes, I guess.
Anyway, so she just acts like she's gonna die. And she does not like being picked up at all. And she doesn't run around or anything when you pick her up. She just holds completely still but goes like, eh. Gorbachev, he loves being held. You can hold him and, like, he's just super happy. So this is why I'm saying there's, like, you know.
Yeah.
There's different reasons.
You love them each for different reasons.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Why are we trying to encourage questions? Doesn't this mean if we're done sooner, don't we get beer sooner?
No, it doesn't start. We got 20 more minutes anyway. They're not starting the happy hour just for us, as much as we'd like to think, as much as they should be.
So you mentioned you hope that more companies will be able to invest in open source contribution, and you've been able to do a lot of this work, a lot of measuring work and that kind of thing. For a lot of us, that's not like an everyday reality, so we aren't measuring things. So two questions. One would be, for the average Rails developer, what would you wish that they were more aware of regularly? So, like, what are the things that you're seeing the average Rails developer do that you wish they wouldn't?
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, if we wanted to get into measurement, if we wanted to get into diving into performance and trying to, I don't know, do the things that you were doing, basically, but on a smaller scale, kind of, if a company isn't investing fully in that, but instead allows us to do 5 hours of it a week, how can we move past just submitting bug fixes and into what you're talking about?
Sure. Good questions. Let's see. First one, things I wish Rails developers would do. And I'm going to say, so I think this is kind of interesting, and probably what I wish that Rails developers would do is to learn Rails.
Yeah.
People here are laughing, but I'm totally serious. Like, I have worked in the past with a lot of people who Rails is their day job, right? They're just doing this to, like, pay their bills and do whatever. Like, Rails is big enough. We're at the point where it's like, this is just corporate job, right? Mm-hmm. What I really would like is more people going to conferences like here. Unfortunately, I can't say, like, hey, you guys should go to conferences because you're already at a conference. But I wish that more people were going to conferences and educating themselves on the framework, because, like, a lot of the code I'll see is just stuff that's like, well, actually, Rails already has a built-in thing to do this. You didn't need to do all this work that you did, and if you had known about how to use Rails better, then we could have just eliminated a whole bunch of work.
Do you think those are discoverability problems, though? Like, some of it is just it's really hard to discover this stuff.
We do have a lot of APIs, and we can only expect people to memorize so many of them.
I mean, I'm sure there's also the other part, right, where it's like paying the bills, and this is how I thought I should do it. But.
Well, I think some of it is that if you're working on a legacy Rails application, like, let's say, for example, one of the apps that I've seen started out at, like, I think Rails 1 something and is all the way upgraded to 4.2. We actually got it upgraded. It's passing tests. Holy shit. So, but I think what some of the problems were is that as they're upgrading and going through all the different versions, developers on the team didn't re-educate themselves in the latest version of Rails. They just like did whatever they possibly could to get it working on the latest version and didn't like re-up their skills.
And then cargo culted stuff from when they were doing it back
exactly.
in 2003.
Exactly, yes, yes, exactly. So, I mean, even if you did, I think that even if you did something as basic as like, when you upgrade Rails, any major upgrade, like 2 to 3, 3 to 4 or whatever, go through the basic tutorials and just build a stupid website just from scratch, right? You don't need it. Just build the basic one that's in the Agile Web Development book, right? Just build that application and then see, like, how is this different than the style that we're using today?
I think another thing that can be helpful, especially if you're ultimately interested in getting more involved, one of the things I started doing before I actually started heavily contributing was just over time I found myself source diving more and more and going to Stack Overflow less and less. And part of that just is the quality of some Stack Overflow answers and things got outdated, and it might also say something about our docs at times, but like you gain a cursory familiarity, and then if it is ultimately a statement about our docs and that there's improvements, then hey, once you have a better understanding of this method, then now great, and you can help us improve our docs, and we would really appreciate that.
The thing is, though, I don't necessarily know if it's a problem with our documentation, because actually pretty much all of our methods are documented. It's just discoverability, like you were saying, is like, how do you formulate the question? You're like, I need to do this thing, which is fairly nebulous. How do you Google for that?
In Haskell, we have a thing for exactly that called Hoogle.
Hoogle?
I'm not kidding. It is an actual thing.
You say the types that you have and the types that you want. It's like, here are all the methods that go from this type to this type.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
That's really awesome.
It's one of the coolest things ever.
Okay, so what was the other
part of the question?
The other question.
If you're wanting to get started, which I think he's
stuff.
Started
yeah.
talking a little bit about that, but yeah.
Let's see.
I mean, are you looking for like low-hanging fruit or easy places to jump into the code base or more general advice?
Well, I feel like what Aaron is saying is a call for people to stop doing the low-hanging fruit as much, maybe.
Yes.
Like, so not so much just fixing bugs, but actually improving, like, the fundamental nature of the code.
Right. So I think the main problem with improving the fundamental nature of the code is that I don't think it's possible to do it in short spurts. Like if you only have a few hours per week or whatever, I just don't think it's possible. I mean, think about the projects that you work on at work, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Could you do those things and could you keep your mind focused on solving that particular problem? Making sure that you have a good code base if it was only, you know, a few hours here and there.
Right.
I don't think you can.
I think you can make steps towards it. You might not actually end up re-architecting anything on the scale of like the new type system, but you can definitely take smaller steps. I think it's just coming back for more than one or two commits is the biggest one, and then just having an emphasis when you do come back on like, I want to leave this file slightly better than it in slightly better shape than it was before I got here.
I mean, you might get to the point where you're studying the code well enough that you're like, oh, you know, Rails really needs a identity mapper, for example.
Oh.
Please no.
That's been tried.
I'm just saying, as an example, you're like, I think that this re-architecting would be really great and we should do that, except that you don't have the time to do it.
Right.
So.
Right. Or it would take you too long.
Too long, yes.
Yeah.
Any other questions? All right.
So in classical MVC, the view layer typically is an actual object, not just a template. And in Rails, typically we get around that by building a presenter object, right? There's either rolling your own or there's several third-party libraries that you're using for that. Are there any chances of something like that coming into Rails at some point?
I mean, form objects are kind of as close as we're ever going to get, I think.
You know, templates technically are objects.
That is true.
In Rails.
You can't subclass it, though.
Why not? You can?
I don't know. Sure? Can you?
I think it's just a class.
If I add methods to it, will I actually change the behavior of my template?
If you add them in the right place, I think so, yeah.
Okay.
They're just not exposed to anybody.
Then let's expose them.
No.
Okay.
We'll probably never get real template objects.
Yeah.
We probably could. No. Okay. I'm not going to say that. You know, I retract that statement. We could have temple objects if we wanted to. It's just that we would have to do it in such a way that the framework behaves exactly the same as it does today.
What about introducing a presenter layer somewhere?
I don't believe in presenters.
Like, you literally do not think they're a thing that exists?
I think it is the stupidest name in the world.
It is.
It is just a delegate. You are delegating.
Yeah.
You are doing object composition and then putting a bunch of objects together and saying, like, hey, I'm going to call some methods on these other ones. It just annoys me.
All right. We've got a recurring trope here. Where do you put that? That
where
file,
do I put that?
Your class that is delegating things, the delegator object. Where do you put that?
I put it on the file system.
That's funny.
Okay,
all right, on the file system.
But so I think that the presenter or whatever that thing that we talked about, like I said, like I like to build one object. Like I've never felt a need to have like a high level thing that does this automatically for me or like any sort of. Like, I don't even use a library for that type of stuff usually. But the form object thing, I think, is very interesting. Like, I think that's where something could improve a lot. That can improve my life a lot.
So I actually think storing them under a presenter's directory or whatever is fine. You could store it wherever you want to. I just, like, it hurts me to the core to think that there is a presenter library.
Yeah.
Because you can just, let me tell you, I should make a presenter library. It would be zero lines. It would be like, okay.
Would it be simple delegator?
Yeah. Yes.
No, it would be delegate class for performance reasons.
Oh, okay.
Delegate class, or just be like, okay, check this out. Do class my object def initialize.
Oh, you just want to multi-patch the object?
No. Write an object. Just write a class.
Oh,
use
yeah.
Ruby.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Okay, what were we talking about?
Form objects.
We're going to get into form objects.
Yeah, that would make
form objects.
You want to talk about a new feature that I think would be welcomed as some sort of response to form objects and the ability to just forget that accepts nested attributes ever existed.
I mean, I think we're getting there, right? So we move the attributes API up to active model. We kind of start to get rid of the idea of the active model API in favor of objects with sane interfaces that have known methods and not underscore send for everything. And then really, I mean, the problems that need to be solved are what? Bubbling up errors, if you're composing three different objects, mm-hmm. having all of the validations from those three and having them bubble up into the single parent, and then
But doesn't
that's
this,
it.
Doesn't that violate SRP?
I mean, it depends on your definition of SRP.
What is the responsibility? Like, what are the multiple responsibilities we're talking about?
I'm actually just bullshitting you.
Okay. Great.
I don't know. Form objects could help.
Yeah, sure. All right, plus one. Next topic.
There's also a library called Cells that you might want to look at that does some interesting stuff.
Yes.
With form object type stuff? Is this really?
No, for view objects.
View objects, yeah.
Oh, okay, cool. One more question, anybody? You get the last word.
Fine. We've answered all the questions. No. I'm glad.
You never have to answer another question again for the rest of your
life.
Well,
except that we're about to go to a office hours thing and answer people's questions.
Okay. Should we wrap up?
Yeah, let's wrap up.
Okay.
What are we wrapping?
The podcast.
Is it really a podcast if it's live?
Well, it'll also be a podcast.
We're not actually
these
live
microphones
streaming.
Aren't like, there's no speakers.
I'm a
we're
speaker.
Recording. What episode?
Ruining the internet one podcast at a time.
Yeah, this was such a good podcast until Aaron came on.
Yeah.
Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/13.
Special thanks to our guest, Aaron Patterson. As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes are much appreciated.
If you want to give us feedback on this episode or any others, you can email us at hosts@bikeshed.fm or tweet us @_bikeshed.
Thanks for listening to The Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.